You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, new reporting says more than 122,000 people are held daily in solitary confinement in U.S. prisons and jails. Find out why its use has become so widespread and why some states are trying something new. That's today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, long-term polling finds that the number of Americans who view patriotism as being very important has dropped a lot over the last 30 years. That's according to a series of surveys from the Wall Street Journal and the pollsters at NORC. And younger people are less likely than previous generations to describe themselves as patriotic. Our next guest says a big factor in that change is a big problem, people putting their partisan goals ahead of the country as a whole. With July 4th, just a week off, we want to hear your thoughts on patriotism. Join in now at 800-642-1234. What does patriotism mean to you? Do you consider yourself patriotic? Do you see people putting political party before national interests? If so, what could we do to fix that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Rick Kite is director of the D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics and Leadership at Viterbo University in La Crosse and co-host of the Ethical Life podcast. He wrote a piece about patriotism for the Wisconsin State Journal. Rick, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. Good to be here.
Now, patriotism might mean different things to different people. Let's get a working definition. What are we talking about when we talk about patriotism?
I tend to think that patriotism is a conviction that we are all bound together and that we're bound together with a national identity. And it is also not just a recognition of that fact, but a celebration of it. Like this is a good thing that we are bound together in different kinds of groups and national identity of one of them. So patriotism is like love of family, love of community. We've also got love of country. So it's one of the many ways in which we celebrate the kind of social identity that we have as human beings.
I mentioned that Wall Street Journal polling that you reference in your piece that I mentioned, upwards of 70% of Americans said, hey, yeah, patriotism, very important back in 1990. That's dropped to the 30-some percent. You know, a lot of people still say it's pretty important. What do you make of that drop?
Well, what I make of it is we are not as bound together at the local level, and then for that reason, when we think about national politics, we are thinking mostly about terms in terms of our friends and our enemies, and not thinking of ourselves as having a national identity, but having national interests that are essentially in competition, And I think that's a dangerous trend. And I think of people like my great uncle who had fought in World War I and who had made a point to like visit, I think, every president after FDR, something like that, when they would come through towns on trains to give the speeches, whether they're Democrat or Republican, because he just thought that was important for him to understand his responsibilities as a citizen. And so I think we have less appreciation for our responsibilities as citizens and kind of more attention to what we demand from the nation.
The core, I think, of your piece is this idea that you were starting to touch on, that we're starting to put our partisan identity and our partisan policy preferences ahead of that idea of shared identity. How did we get there? What do you think is driving that?
Well, I think it's lack of participation at the local level. And we have all this data now on like each generation has fewer friends, fewer social interactions than the generation before. And that loss of social connection pretty much tracks with the decline in patriotism. And the way I think they're connected is when you have a lot of social connections at the local level, you regularly interact with people who disagree with you. But you find out they're not really that bad of people. You just disagree about some things. And so then you make the assumption nationally, well, most people are like that. I might disagree with them, but they're not really bad people. But when you don't have those kinds of diverse social connections at the local level, you start to think that the people who disagree with you actually are really bad people. And it's hard then to think of oneself as having a shared identity with them.
Talking to Rick Kite with Viterbo University in La Crosse, looking at what it means to be patriotic, why there's been a decline in the number of people who say patriotism is very important to them in polling here in the United States. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What does patriotism mean to you? Do you consider yourself patriotic? What would it take to bridge some of the partisan divides over big issues and over identity in the United States? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Rick, before we go to our callers, I want to quote from your piece in the State Journal here. We will never come to widespread agreement about many of the goals we seek for our nation. The best we can do is come to agreement about the means by which we pursue those goals. So I think that's super interesting, the idea of respecting the system and the process, even when we don't get the outcome we want. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, when you look at something like the Constitution, it sets forth kind of like what, as Americans, we consider to be broad goals, but then it specifies pretty precisely, you know, what the means are, what are the rules we have to follow, because of course we aren't going to all agree on all of the issues, all of the goals that we have, and so this understanding of like, well, how does government work? What are its limitations? What are the responsibilities of citizenship? These are all about process. They're all about means. And that's where we shape our kind of national unity. And especially, I mean, you can kind of do these kinds of calculations when you find out that we have such closely contested elections and the number of things that people have opinions on that they would like to see made either legal or illegal. It turns out that the majority of people are frustrated in their wishes the majority of the time. And so you can have the expectation, I'll be happy once I get the majority of the things that I want, you know, as a partisan player. That's simply not going to happen. You have to say, okay, I'm going to be satisfied if at least we're all following the rules. And I think there's a path forward with that. I just don't think we're paying enough attention to it.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Julia is with us in Madison. Julia, hi.
Hi. I am, just to be upfront, a white middle-class American who was raised very much appreciating patriotism and small town, rural, growing up in parades, to honor veterans. And what I've come to see that the word patriotism has evolved into something that is an ideology that is different than it used to be, and I don't agree with. Patriotism was an African-American in the right before the World War II, standing on a track and field athlete, standing up and holding up his hand to be proud to be an American. And what we've done to quarterback Kaepernick is atrocious to me. He respectfully used his power, his position, to try to draw attention to something that he feels is important. And now he can't even do his job as an athlete. And I see him as a role model. I see him as someone that I would want my African-American children and everybody to look up to, because he used his position for speaking to something that was unfair. We've been based on slavery way too long, and we've never apologized. And even Germany has done that for its atrocities. And so,
Julia, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. Rick, your thoughts on Julia's views on our changes in what we think about patriotism?
Yeah, I think unfortunately the word patriotism itself has become a partisan marker. And especially for many people who identify more as liberal or progressive, they kind of cringe at the word because it seems to be kind of owned by the right wing. I think that's unfortunate. I think it needs to be reclaimed by all Americans. I don't like this tendency of one party wanting to claim kind of the patriotic label, because then it becomes identified more with with partisan goals rather than the process by which we shape our lives together. I have mixed feelings about the Colin Kaepernick protest. I think I agree that he was really shabbily treated. I think it was unwise for him to choose to protest against the national anthem, perfectly within his rights, and we need to respect that. I mean, this is part of patriotism too, is respect people that don't agree with our national symbols. And it's certainly something that draws a great deal of attention, of course, which is why he did it. But I also think it's unfortunate. I think that's not a way that you, if you really want to bring attention to a widespread problem, that the only way it's going to get addressed is by addressing it together. You don't do it by making the national symbol itself the means of protest.
Julia, thanks for the call. Rick Kite stays with us from Viterbo University in La Crosse. We're looking at patriotism in divided times, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. When you think about people you disagree with politically, do you think there's common ground that you can agree on, meet on amid the debates? What does patriotism mean to you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk about patriotism and the partisan divide with Rick Kite, director of the D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics and Leadership at Viterbo University in La Crosse, co-host of the Ethical Life podcast. His piece from the Wisconsin State Journal on this topic is linked at WPR.org/Central Time. Let's go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Jason is with us in Madison. Jason, hi.
Hi, Rob. I called in because I've never actually considered myself all that much of a patriot until recently, when I find the system of American democracy is under attack, and suddenly I find myself compelled to defend it.
And do you think you've taken action, Jason? What kind of things have you done with this newfound idea of patriotism?
To be honest, I don't think I've done enough. I've proceeded with my civic duties as I have before, just a newfound sense of purpose and trying to convince the people I talk to that maybe they should find that purpose too.
Gotcha. Jason, thanks a lot for the call. Rick, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that's fantastic. I really think it's important to reclaim the idea of patriotism. I think it's and I think it's important to emphasize that it is not a matter of taking sides in the political debates. It's a matter of finding common ground, finding unity with our citizens so that we can work together to make life better for all of us. And I don't think that's a partisan issue. I think that's something most Americans would say, yeah, I agree with that. We should make life better. And we have to have some understanding of, like, we have a shared commitment in this project, and we want things to be better for the next generation. And so how do we do it? And so congratulations. That's great that you're considering yourself a patriot, because we need people that are part of this effort to reclaim the very idea.
Thanks for the call. Richard joins us now in Two Rivers. Richard, hi.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me on the air. My question's kind of simple but complicated. It's why and when did we have such a disrespect for our presidents? I mean, I've never seen it more than flying two flags off the back of your pickup truck than I've seen now, and there's no discussion about it. Well, why and when did it happen?
Richard, thanks for the call. Rick, do you think we've gotten more willing to express our dissatisfaction, maybe even in vulgar terms, against our presidents? If so, why?
I'm not sure about that. When you go back in history, mm-hmm. you find a lot of contempt for various presidents. And we've had some real bad presidents. and you know, some presidents are fairly good at kind of unifying the nation, usually in times of some kind of national crisis. But I think what we've really lost is respect for the institution and the ability to distinguish the office from the individual. And that's part of the reason for that, I think, is the gradual growth of executive power over the years, so that, you know, like most people really think that the president acts pretty much like a king and implements whatever kind of policies they want. And when you hear during the campaign time of the presidential candidates, you hear people talking about what will happen if their opponent gets elected, and they really seem to think they have pretty much unfettered power. And that's a problem, because the higher the stakes are, the higher the more the rhetoric ramps up and the more the emotion ramps up. And so part of toning down that public contempt for the person who holds the office is understanding the limitations on their power. And I think also working harder to restore the power that should be held by both Congress and the courts.
Thanks for that call. And that seems like a danger here, Rick. If individuals are putting their party identity, their partisan goals first, it seems like there's often a lot of at least very vocal pressure on a president, on our guy, whichever side you're on our guy to push the rules, bend the rules, take more power in order to accomplish what I want them to do, and forget those institutional checks and balances that are there for a reason. Is that a worry for you?
That's a really significant worry. And I make the claim in the column that most people right now function as short-term consequentialists. And that is that they're focused on immediate results, and they tend to think that an action is right if it has good results. And that's not what, like, when I teach ethics, that's not the main part of ethics that I'm teaching. Ethics is mostly about the various kinds of constraints we place on ourselves and upon one another based on the certain types of actions. So we say, like, you shouldn't cheat, you shouldn't lie, you shouldn't steal. Not because those some things might not sometimes get you some good results, it's because of the type of action. And so we have to have more understanding in our nation of a kind of an allegiance, a commitment to the process of and so that's why that worries me. This pressure we have, I think, on our politicians to just get us the results we want, no matter how they do it.
I want to spend our last few minutes looking at possible solutions, Rick. And one thing you really are making the case for in your piece and here on the air is for people to get involved at the local level in politics. One hurdle there is, you know, you have to go to a place and it takes time to get involved. It can be a little boring to sit through public meetings sometimes versus the quick fix of, I'm going to make an angry comment on social media and that's my political participation. How do we get people to overcome that that convenience problem of involvement?
Yeah, it can be really boring, especially if one is only a casual participant. And so, like, the more you get involved, the more interesting it becomes, because you begin to know the players more, you form kind of relationships with them, and you understand the process and what's actually going on. But the first step is a really simple one. It's simply joining social groups, joining social organizations, and making a commitment to make it a part of your life. And what we've seen in America is a real growth in private life and a diminishment of social life. And so I don't think there's any way to recover patriotism without restoring a kind of robust social life. And that's where we start.
And then you've talked a lot today about, you know, seeing that political opponent as a fellow American, as not an enemy, but as, you know, maybe an adversary on these particular debates. I've had a lot of conversations on this show with people who try to bring together people from different points of view. Where do you see opportunities? Where do you see ways that we can get people from different backgrounds, different partisan views to embrace that shared American identity?
We begin by loving our neighbor. We begin by loving our actual neighbor, whether we like them or not. And then we extend it to our metaphorical neighbor, the person that maybe we see across the state or across the country. So that becomes a habit. But it starts really close to home.
And then where do we take it from there? We often now separate ourselves geographically, so we're more likely to agree with that neighbor. How do we move to that next step?
Move to the next step by working as hard as we can to sympathetically understand people. And the more we understand people's lives, the harder it is to hate them. And that goes to everybody. It goes, you know, to our real neighbor, but it also goes to the politician. And so try not to see people who represent us, say at the state level or the national level, just as these one or two dimensional figures, but as real human beings. Get to know something of their story.
Briefly, Rick, are you optimistic that we can do these things?
Yeah, I am. And I'm optimistic because I see within young people, I see a real desire for community. I think there's a lot of headwinds against them, but there's a real desire for community, and I think that's where our hope lies.
Rick, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Rick Kite, director of the D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics and Leadership at Viterbo University in La Crosse, co-host of the Ethical Life podcast. We've got a link to his piece on patriotism and appeared in the Wisconsin State Journal. Find that link at wpr.org/centraltime. And keep sharing your thoughts on the meaning of patriotism. Email ideas@wpr.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the U.S. saw increased attention to public health efforts at the beginning of COVID, but less attention now. An epidemiologist joins the show to say that that's a common cycle of panic and neglect, and it leaves us less prepared for the next disease outbreak. Plus, we'll look at higher rates of depression here in the United States, some of the causes and some possible solutions. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, Wisconsin ranks last in the nation in per capita state funding for the arts. We'll learn more about efforts to increase that funding and what challenges the current levels create. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll check out a proposed $3.5 billion income tax cut here in Wisconsin and what it could mean for the state. First, arts and cultural organizations were hit hard at the start of the pandemic. Over $400 million of state and federal COVID relief funding helped keep Wisconsin's creative industry afloat when doors were closed and gatherings were limited. That one-time cash infusion was a big deal for organizations around the state, but now they're back to their regular funding level from the state government, among the lowest in the country. According to the National Assembly of State Arts Agencies, Wisconsin currently ranks last in the nation in per capita state funding for the arts and has ranked at or near the bottom for many years. In this year's budget cycle, Governor Tony Evers proposed significant increases to arts funding in the state using some of Wisconsin's budget surplus. The Republican-controlled Joint Finance Committee rejected those proposals. They intend to maintain a similar level of arts funding, just enough to continue to receive matching funds from the federal government. During the Joint Finance Committee's deliberations over tourism funding earlier this month, Democratic State Representative Evan Goyke of Milwaukee called for an increase in arts spending, was ultimately unsuccessful.
Back in 2011, arts, the state portion of arts funding was $3 million. And it was reduced, and it has not been increased. We have set aside the bare minimum to receive the national match. And I think we can do a lot better than the bare minimum. I think we can do a lot better. And I think Wisconsin would be better for that.
A group of arts organizations around the state have teamed up to form the Wisconsin Creative Economy Coalition to advocate for more state funding. That may be unlikely in the current state of the budget process. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see the state put more money into arts and cultural programming, or should that be left up to private donations and revenue? What do you think more funding for the arts could do for your local community? Why do you think the state hasn't been more willing to fund the arts? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ann Katz is the executive director of Create Wisconsin, the community cultural development organization formerly known as Arts Wisconsin. She also previously served on the board of directors for the Wisconsin Public Radio Association. Ann, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. How are you?
Good. Can you give us a sense of what we're talking about? We talk about arts organizations and the creative economy in the state. Give us the scope of the kind of things we're talking about.
Well, we're talking about businesses, people, businesses, organizations, and communities in every corner of the state. Yes, nonprofit organizations are the cornerstone of the creative industries. For-profit businesses are also a huge part of that industry, and that's everything from music stores to electronic theater controls in Middleton to independent artists who have a gallery, people who work in any kind of music production, studios. The list is endless. There's also a lot of interest and programming from the university system, K-12, education, schools and such, local government, economic development, pretty much in a lot of ways, everything is the creative economy. And let me, before I forget to say this, I have to say that it's a $10.8 billion, that's billion with a B, billion dollar industry, according to the U.S. Department of Commerce. And in 2021, so in the middle of the pandemic, there were over 87,000 jobs, which is more jobs than the state's beer, biotech, and papermaking industries. So this is a sector worthy of attention and investment. And although, as you mentioned at the top of the hour, we are 50th out of 50 states in per capita funding of our state arts council, I have a lot of optimism that that is going to turn because the momentum is growing.
Can you give us a sense of the history of arts funding in the state? We used to, as we heard from Representative Goyke, fund at higher levels. What happened over time?
We were always kind of in the mid-40s. And I think as at some point before 2011, we were up to, I think, 44 cents per capita. In 2011, Governor Walker's budget cut the arts board by a significant amount, and that went down to just under $1 million. It hasn't, the investment hasn't grown since then, as Representative Goyke said, and due to inflation, of course, that money is worth less. The other side of that is that the state does, like every arts council, the Wisconsin Arts Board gets matching funding from the National Endowment for the Arts, and so that does double the amount of money that we have available. But in a world where Minnesota provides over $7 per capita and Illinois provides over $5 per capita, we can't compete. Wisconsin can't compete if we're only at 14 cents per capita and 50th in the nation. And we deserve better. The people of the state deserve better. The people and organizations and businesses producing the arts deserve better because they're doing amazing things with that small amount of money, and they could do so much more, and they could reach so many more people if there was more investment.
The state government has a lot of different competing priorities for what to do with money that comes in from taxpayers. Why the arts? Make the case for public state-level funding for these arts organizations.
Well, as I said, it's a $10.8 billion industry, and that's more than some of our historic industries and more than some of our emerging industries. The arts are a catch-all term for economic programs, education for the 21st century, vibrant communities, bringing in and engage residents. The arts bring people together. And when you talk about the intangible value of the arts, which is that the arts make us human, humans have been expressing themselves creatively since the beginning of time, and that it is an industry where, you know, a theater or an art center or a festival, people come to that a town. They fill up their tanks at the gas station. They stay in hotels. They go shopping. They pay for babysitters if they're in town. For residents and visitors alike, the arts are a huge part of daily life and of what people do when they're on vacation. And so it's a robust sector that we shouldn't think of as something that's separate from everything else in the world. There's not like the arts over here and then everything else in the real world is on the other side. The arts are part of everything we do, and the arts businesses and creative workers are part of the fabric of our community. They're our neighbors. They're, you know, they're people that pay taxes, have mortgages, send their kids to public school. And so when we talk about funding the arts, we're really talking about funding investment in the economy, workforce, and community life.
Talking to Ann Katz with Create Wisconsin, looking at art funding here in Wisconsin in the state budget. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Per person in Wisconsin, we are ranked last in the country when it comes to the amount of money we put into the arts. What do you think about that? Would you like to see it change? Are you okay with it? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And Governor Evers' budget proposal, which is mostly fallen by the wayside in joint finance now, he had called for an artistic endowment fund, putting $100 million into that and using interest from that to help fund arts funding, plus a direct increase in annual arts funding. What did you think when you saw his plan?
Oh, ecstatic, thrilled. We very much appreciate the governor's show of support. And that really kind of catalyzed this Creative Economy Coalition, which has been, you know, it's been out there for years and years, but this moment in time was a moment where people came together and said, this is a great opportunity. Let's really work hard for it. Now, that part of the budget, as you said, is not going to be in the final version of the budget, but we're going to keep the momentum going and we're going to keep advocating. You know, one thing I should say, Rob, is that there isn't anyone who doesn't understand that the world has changed. Even before the pandemic, the world was changing and our economy is different. You know, we don't make cars in Wisconsin anymore. We don't really make paper here anymore. We have thousands and thousands of entrepreneurs who are running small businesses and are all incredibly creative. Everybody understands that. It doesn't matter what side of the aisle you're on. And I have spent a lot of time in the legislature, and I can tell you that everyone is interested in new ways of revitalizing their communities and finding ways for people to make their living and to help people be entrepreneurial and creative. So that's why I say I have a lot of optimism about the momentum and how we're going to, even though this budget did not contain the $100 million, and again, we're very grateful that that conversation has started with the governor's request, we're going to keep it going and we're going to keep working to show that the arts, the creative industries and the creative economy is a good investment.
What have you and the creative organizations you're working with done to try to reach out to the Republican leadership and the legislature, who have obviously a lot of say in what happens in the budget?
Well, we have relationships, you know, people working on the ground in their communities, whether it's a big city or a small town, they know their legislators. They see them at the supermarket. They go to church with them. They, you know, sometimes they're married to each other. People have relationships with their decision makers, and Wisconsinites are not afraid to express their opinions. So, you know, that's kind of how it works. People trust people that they know. They pay attention to things that they understand. And so the arts are a sector. We have a lot of stories to tell. We have a lot of great work going on. And the people on the ground, the people who are doing the real work, they have been reaching out to their decision makers, showing them not only, again, the intrinsic value and how many people's lives are changed, which, of course, is, you know, incredibly important, but they also are able to show the economic value when someone buys a ticket to a show, when someone comes to town, when someone, you know, does a night out going to a performance or a museum or whatever. They are able to show the economic and the civic impact, so that twin, you know, that twin set of impacts, they are able to show that to their decision makers and show that, again, I keep repeating this, but this is a sector worthy of investment, again, from the ground up, you know, from that any legislator in any district can see that their district has X number of organizations, X number of events, all sorts of reasons why people would want to come and partake of the arts. And I, as I said, there isn't anyone who doesn't understand that, whether you're Republican, Democrat, or something in between. So that's how we're doing it, you know, grassroots, one at a time, people having relationships with the people who make decisions.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Denny is with us in Ogdensburg. Denny, hi.
Hey, thanks for having me. A quick overview. I was on a village council a number of years ago in central Wisconsin. Our area was down to a finalist of a company going to start a business with 200 employees. It was a regional location of an existing company. It was down to us in a village in a city in North Carolina. When they came to look at what we had to offer, the guy said, my wife is into arts and into the community, and she will never live here. And our art community has grown tenfold in the last 10 years, and it's the backbone of part of our area in central Wisconsin. And I am not an artist. It's not like I'm talking as an artist looking for more. I'm just telling you, from a business standpoint, it's critical not only to bring businesses in, but to bring people in that you want in your business. Thank you.
Denny, thanks for the call. Ann.
Denny, bless you. That is, you're singing my song. I mean, that's the kind of testimony that Denny, and we so appreciate that, that Denny has given and that we hear all the time. People want to live in places where there are things to do, whether they are, consider themselves artists or not. They want things for their kids to do. They want arts education in the schools. They want zoos and libraries and art centers. And they want a lively community. And if your community can't provide it, then they'll find some other place to live. And so that's why, as I said, so many local officials and economic development professionals are so interested in investing in their creative economy. So I'm spending a lot of time in that world, and we have a very good partnership with the League of Wisconsin Municipalities and the Wisconsin Counties Association, spending a lot of time with these decision makers on the local level, talking about how they can boost their creative economy in their community. Now, it's a process. There's no magic solution where all of a sudden, poof, you're going to, you know, have 10 different galleries and lots of things going on. You have to really work at it. But that's what people are trying to do. And there's not enough money. There's not enough time. There's not enough anything. But yet people are really trying to do these kinds of this kind of investment and development in their communities.
Denny, thanks for the call. We're talking to Ann Katz, Executive Director of Create Wisconsin, looking at arts funding here in Wisconsin and how our state lags behind most of the rest of the nation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the state should be responsible for more arts funding, maybe in this current budget that we're working on right now? How important is the creative economy to you? Is it part of your livelihood, part of your community? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Ann Katz, Executive Director of Create Wisconsin, the Community Cultural Development Organization, formerly known as Arts Wisconsin, with us today to talk about the state's low level of arts funding and efforts to increase it in the next state budget. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. How important are the creative arts to you? Do you have outlets in your community, places where you can go to participate in creativity in one form or another? Do you want to see more? Call 800-642-1234. Let's go back to our callers. Perry is with us in Oconto. Perry, hi.
Yes, I wanted to kind of tack on to what Denny said. Great point where people want to move where there's opportunities for recreation and the arts and that things that are important to them. Not one of the legislatures talked about last week on the radio saying, well, we got to cut taxes because people don't want to move to Wisconsin because taxes are so high.
Perry, thanks for the call and thanks for previewing our next conversation. That's coming up. We'll look at those tax cuts. But Ann, we were talking about businesses being drawn to Wisconsin. Perry saying people drawn to Wisconsin, he hopes, if we supported our arts more.
Well, I mean, Wisconsin has everything, right? I mean, we have authentic, unique communities. We have very creative people. We have great history and heritage. And that's what people want. And our small towns are located near their communities. And so, I mean, we really do have everything we need here. We just have to make more of an investment. Yes, people want low taxes, but they also want, as I said before, they want things to do. They want lively communities. They want something real. And if you're living in, a suburb somewhere and you have to drive to go to Walmart or Starbucks, you know, the fact that you can live in a real community and partake of local culture, local arts and culture and heritage, Wisconsin really does have it all. So we really push the idea that supporting the arts that's not the phrase we use. We really talk about investing in people, organizations, businesses, and communities.
Thanks a lot for that call. Now, Anne, people might think of arts funding and picture a big art museum or concert hall or something like that. I'm guessing the organizations you work with, it's not one size fits all, that arts investment might look different in a small town versus a big city. Can you share some of that variety?
Oh, my gosh. We've got nothing but variety here, right? We've got... you know, we do have the big world-class institutions like the Milwaukee Art Museum and the Madison Symphony and located in the big cities. But we also have world-class institutions like Big Top Chautauqua, which is located in a very small town, but people know it around the world, and everything in between. Really, I keep using the phrase authentic and unique, but that's really the hallmark of our arts and culture, that people are expressing their culture, their heritage, their history, their emotions through the arts. And whether it's if it's a small gallery in a small town or a studio tour somewhere or, you know, a tribal museum, I could go on about the different kinds of arts experiences in this state, but we really do have an incredible variety of arts experiences. And again, that's what people want. And one more thing I should say, you know, there's a lot of cultural tourism in the state. So people come to Wisconsin to go to places like Big Top, to the art museum, to go to art fairs and art shows. And they also go to hike or ski at the same time. And so our tourism mix is pretty diverse because people will go on a bike ride in the morning and then they'll go to a winery in the afternoon and then they'll go to a performance indoor county at night. And so, you know, our visitors who can turn into residents sometimes also are able to partake of the incredible diversity. And so, you know, my favorite thing about my job is that I get to go around the state and see all this and experience it. So, you know, I'm a big fan of the arts in Wisconsin and what people are doing. Again, not enough money, not enough resources, but that's what we're trying to change.
We heard from Ellen in Milwaukee, who couldn't stay on the line. Ellen says, very sad to hear Wisconsin ranks last in arts funding, wants to know what in the world people like Ellen could do about it. What would you say to Ellen, Ann?
Oh, my gosh. Go to createwisconsin.org and wisconsincreates.com. Those are the two websites where createwisconsin.org is our website, and it's got lots of information about the arts. And then wisconsincreates.com is the Creative Economy Coalition website, and that's got information about how you can be an advocate. So I hope Ellen and everybody else does that. And then if you have a question, give me a call, send me an email. I'm happy to talk.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Ann Katz, Executive Director of Create Wisconsin, a community cultural advocacy organization. She's with us today to talk about Wisconsin's low levels of state arts funding and efforts to boost it in the current budget cycle. That's still in the works in the state legislature right now. You can keep that conversation going over at the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. And hey, if you want to give a shout out to a local creative enterprise, big or small, famous or not in your community, we would love to hear about it. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. If there's something in that creative economy, a local museum or gallery or performance space or public art, you name it, that, you know, when somebody comes to visit from out of town, you like to take them to go see it, let us know about it. Email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up after the news, the Republican-controlled Budget Writing Committee in the state legislature passed a $3.5 billion income tax proposal. If passed, it would lower the state's tax brackets from 4 down to 3, lower the tax levels in those brackets. A UW River Falls economics professor tells us how these tax cuts could affect the state economy. As always, you can join that conversation. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.